When the Missouri House reconvenes next year, Republicans will have a commanding majority. And one member of this exclusive club is State Representative Kirk Matthews. The St. Louis County Republican joins us on another edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say. Hands to kiss and babies to shake.
But I think my record speaks for itself.
It's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joe Manis is off today, so as my special guest host, we have...
Duri Buscarin, thanks for having me.
Thank you for filling in for Joe. And as our special guest today, all the way from around Pacific, Missouri,
yes,
we have as our special guest today...
I'm Kirk Matthews, State Representative from District 110.
And we wanted to ask you before we got into your life story, how is Pacific in that part of St. Louis County, Franklin County doing? Because both Duri and I covered the flooding there at the beginning of this year and the end of last year. We know it was a pretty devastating flood, but we also know that people were coming together pretty well from what we saw.
The communities, both Eureka and Pacific, are in my district. And as you guys know, you covered the flood. Both were hit pretty hard. They were hit in a little bit different ways. Eureka really was hit more in a commercial district. There was some residential, and I don't want to discount that. They were hit hard. But there was some 280 homes in Pacific that were uninhabitable for some period of time. And the community spirit of coming around and helping those people was astounding. I mean, I was out there throwing sandbags with people, leaders from the community. Everybody was coming together. I think the Pacific area has had a more difficult time recovering because of the nature of the damage being more residential than commercial, I think. But they are getting there. They had some hiccups with FEMA, and they're still trying to get some of that disaster relief funding to flow. So they're not out of the woods completely yet, but they are still working hard at it. And I've worked with several of the aldermen there, and they have a newly hired city manager in the city of Pacific, which seems to be a very good thing too. And that's helped because the flood happened at a time when they were without a city manager. So. It was a kind of a perfect storm, no pun intended.
I'll always remember this little 3-year-old girl, and I met her mom, and they said that she had her third birthday in a Red Cross shelter.
No,
it was just really – but apparently the group there, like, they had a little party for her, brought her presents. It was really sweet.
Well, that was the amazing thing, to see the community come together to help each other. The senior center there that I've done a lot of work with in the past, Tim Baker helps run that senior center, and their ability to help impact that community and help them get back on their feet, provide meals and places to stay. It was pretty amazing.
And is the Pacific Opera House fully functional again?
It is, yes.
That's great to hear.
That's a great venue. Sounds like you've been there.
I did a whole feature on it. So it's just a neat building, has a lot of historical relevance to it. And it was hit pretty hard in this flood.
It was.
And it's been a gathering place in Pacific for decades. And Harry S. Truman once played piano in it.
Yes, he did.
That's its claim to fame. So we're glad to hear that there has some progress on that. Obviously, when there's a flood that big, it's going to take a while for people to completely recover. But as we mentioned on the outset, Duri and I covered that and the people there extensively, so we wanted to get an update on that.
Sure. Thank you for asking.
So before we again ask you about you, can you just give our listeners a sense of what your district encompasses?
Sure. The 110th district basically takes in the southern half of Wildwood, mm-hmm. all of the city of Eureka, as far south as the Merrimack River, which is also the border of Jefferson County. So as long as we're in St. Louis County down there, we're in my district. And a portion of eastern Franklin County that includes most of the city limits of Pacific and a little bit of territory heading north out of Pacific, So that's pretty much encompasses the district.
And it's a heavily Republican district, so much so that I don't think a Democrat has run recently. And even if they did, their chances of winning are pretty low, from my understanding.
That's right. We have, I think, about a 65% Republican district there or so. I did, as we were visiting before the show, I did have a Democratic opponent in my first run in 2014. And they were disqualified by the Secretary of State for some reason. I never did find out why. I think the person maybe owned a business in the district but didn't reside in the district or something like that. So it was my suspicion, but I never did really find out why.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you did before you ran for office in 2014, and what kind of prompted you to get involved in the whirly, crazy world of Missouri politics.
Well, I think you describe it fairly accurately, Jason. So I had never run for elected office before, and I'd been active in helping people run, working polls for Republican candidates and that sort of thing. But I never really thought that much about running, just a little bit. I'd been asked before to run for state representative, and my background is actually healthcare. In the mid-'80s, I began working in the field of healthcare recruiting. I recruited physicians, and my clients were hospitals. And I worked for one of the larger physician recruiting companies in the country. That's based here in the St. Louis area. excuse me. And in 1997, I left there and started my own company. I had a partner, Terry Orff was my partner. And we started a physician practice management company. And the physicians that we hired and contracted to hospitals were hospitalists. They specialize in the field of hospital medicine.
So what is a hospitalist?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a hospitalist is a physician that only cares for the hospitalized patient. They don't have an office where you could see them for any ambulatory needs. So the idea really got started around the idea that it would be a more efficient way to deliver care. So, for example, Jason, if under the traditional model where your internist or your family physician was caring for you both as an outpatient and if you happened to be hospitalized, they would probably come and make hospital rounds at 0:30 in the morning and then return to their office because they'd have 30 or 40 patients to see in the office that day. If your second day in the hospital, your test results came back and said you were cleared to go home, your physician would not see those test results or sign those test results at best the end of the day and sometimes not until the following morning. So you would be spending time in the hospital without cause. As the hospitalist model basically has a physician in the hospital all the time so they can be more efficient with getting discharge orders signed, et cetera. Their scope of practice has expanded greatly over the nearly 20 years since I started my company. But that's what we did. We would produce these hospital medicine programs for hospitals all over the country.
You actually weren't supposed to be the Republican candidate in your district in 2014. There was another candidate. I believe his name was Dennis Broadbrooks. Is that his name?
That's correct, yeah.
And I've actually met him several times, so it's kind of embarrassing. I couldn't pronounce his last name
much. Dennis is a good guy.
Yeah. He had actually filed to succeed House Speaker Tim Jones in
correct.
The Missouri House. He was the only candidate from either party to file once filing closed. So he was effectively the state rep elect after filing closed.
That's correct.
But then he withdrew for reasons I believe are personal in nature we don't have to get into right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you stepped forward. So my question for you is, there aren't that many people who kind of – you know, at the beginning of a year, don't expect to be a state rep and don't have any plans to be a state rep and then become a state rep pretty much without too much trouble. I mean, oftentimes some of these seats are very hotly contested and literally millions of dollars are spent. How did that feel to be in that situation which I just described?
Well, it was unique to say the least, and I think you hit the nail on the head. It was a very unique situation. Dennis had actually asked me to run before he filed. He's a friend of mine. I've known Dennis for a long time. And when I learned that he needed to step down from the race, it was very surprising to me. And it's not something that I, as I mentioned before, I had given some consideration, but nothing serious, certainly not in 2014. But I was in a place where I had sold my business, and I do consulting work and executive recruiting work now. And so I had some flexibility with my time and my income. And I had reached the place where I thought, you know, I was concerned with the direction of the state and the country, quite frankly. I have 7 grandkids today, and the rate of change in the way the country has been going over my lifetime, I was not one of the younger freshmen in my freshman class, in legislative class. The rate of change seems to be picking up, and I thought that if this continued rate of change continues through the life of my grandchildren, we might not recognize this country and our state by the time they get to be my age. So it was one of those deals where it was literally an opportunity to step up. I had no idea whether there would be opposition. Had Dennis stepped down after a certain date, and I think that date was, I don't recall, it was June something or other, then it would have gone to a committee appointment process.
Yes.
But as it was, he did not step down in the right time frame for that, and it became an open filing for anybody to refile.
And you filed?
I did.
And as you mentioned before, there was a Democrat who filed who was disqualified, and State Representative Kirk Matthews, here we are.
It took a little while to get used to hearing that.
I'm sure it does.
Can I ask you, when you say rate of change in your lifetime, what are you referring to specifically?
Well, the way I look at the world from a pretty conservative perspective, and I think that what was considered when I was as a young adult, when I was a high school kid growing up in West St. Louis County, I grew up in my district, went to Pond Elementary School and Lafayette High School out in West St. Louis County. What was considered to be conservative then versus a moderate then versus a liberal thinker at that point or a progressive thinker, I think that has changed. I think I'm 59 years old. I think in my lifetime I've seen the center of that what has moved substantially to the left, in my opinion. And that's kind of what I'm talking about almost across any topic. If you take any topic that you want to discuss, I would. My perception was that the center, that the right was losing its voice, and that the center had moved considerably to the left at a fairly rapid rate over my lifetime.
So you're in the Missouri legislature now. I believe you won re-election because you didn't have an opponent.
I wound up with a write-in opponent, actually. That officially filed with the state and everything.
How many votes did the write-in candidate get?
I think he got 300.
Out of what, like 10,000 votes?
My tally was like 15,005.
Wow.
Something like that.
So. Well, that write-in candidate clearly needed to do more work because they were not successful. So we don't know what committees you're going to be on as of this recording, but you have been on the House Budget Committee, and obviously you know quite a bit about health care. Dury, I think we were going to talk a little bit about the nexus between budgetary stuff and healthcare stuff. So I'll let you take it from here.
Sure. I mean, how, at least since you've been serving, how has your background in healthcare affected how you see health policy when it comes across your desk?
I think it's a really good question. In typical government fashion, when you win a seat in the legislature, you get to submit to your caucus leader, in this case, the Speaker of the House, what your interests are, et cetera. So I put some health care committees on my request list. And in typical government fashion, I didn't get any health care committees. So I was assigned to budget. I was assigned to transportation. I've been served as vice chair of general laws, et cetera. But sitting on the budget committee, I have been exposed to some health care issues, obviously, as you would suspect. And my healthcare background is from the provider perspective, meaning the physicians, the allied health professionals, and the hospitals. I have a pretty clear a lot of experience in that field. I'm learning more about the payer side. I had to deal with payers a lot with managed care companies, et cetera, when I owned my own business. And I think that what my experience as it relates to the legislature is, and in particular, obviously, the conversation would turn toward Medicaid, right, which has been a very difficult subject for our state. Our Medicaid spending has continued to go up and up and up and up. while we have resisted the formal expansion of the Obamacare Medicaid plan and the exchanges. So everyone that's come and lobbied me, and I've spoken to, and that happens frequently, as you might suspect, and talks about their desire to see Medicaid expanded, I say, look, in my perspective, from a managing a group of providers, we employed 100 to 150 physicians at any given point in time in my company's lifetime, is that I viewed Medicaid as a deeply flawed system, as a dramatically flawed system. That, and I would not be opposed to expanding Medicaid on if a couple things would happen, that we could fix the flaws and that we could do a better job of identifying the truly needy in our state. I don't think we do a good job of that. I think those are, you know, people that have truly limited options that are in true desperate need of help are the people that we need to be helping. But I can give you examples from my healthcare experience. We helped several hospitals in the St. Louis area start their hospital medicine programs during when I owned my company. And on more than one occasion, we had the privilege of caring for notables, people that whose if I mentioned their name, of which I, of course, can't and won't do, everyone in St. Louis would know their name. But they were a Medicaid enrollee because they had transferred all their assets into other hands, trusts, et cetera, and yet they were taking their health care on the state. And abuses like that,
are you specifically speaking about elderly people who spend down their assets to be a dual qualifier for Medicaid, Medicare?
Yes, yeah, that, okay. But kind of on steroids, because they are people that I knew that everyone would know didn't have to spend down their assets, but they disguise their assets or they move their assets.
So wealthy people that you knew were dual enrolled Medicare, Medicaid to pay for end of life care?
Yep. Well, not end-of-life care, just their normal health care.
Okay.
They were a Medicare enrollee, and then some of them weren't even Medicare age. I think that we have too many perverse incentives baked into a lot of our entitlement programs. I think, you know, when a single mother has more incentive to have another baby out of wedlock, and if the father enters the household in a marriage arrangement, she loses money. That's, in my mind, that's a perverse incentive. You know, we're not incentivizing the right things. So when I talk about the system identifying the truly needy, I think we ought to have a system that really helps people up and not simply help them out and continue to incentivize life choices that are not conducive to them getting off of Medicaid. From the standpoint of the system being broken, I mean, God, you could almost name the state. We would have, when I was operating my business, at any point in time, we would have accounts receivable from Medicaid programs in various states around the country. Frequently, we would call and say, you know, what's the status of this claim or this batch of claims that we're getting need to get reimbursed on? And the response was, we're out of money right now. Call us back in 6 weeks. Maybe if we have some money, then we'll put you on the list or we'll get you some money. And if the government purchase of healthcare and expects to engage private practice physicians, they can't operate a business that way. So I'm not interested in expanding what I see as a terribly flawed system without fixing the flaws and really trying to make sure that the system helps those that truly need the help.
And I think that especially for the dual-eligible Medicare-Medicaid thing, there was an attempt at a fix last year in which they raised the
asset.
Yeah, they raised limit. The asset limit. So a lot of people, when they're reaching their end of their life, they have to go into a nursing home. But it's one of those things where if a family is looking at a very large, unforeseen healthcare expense, a lot of people will spend down their assets so they qualify for a Medicare, Medicaid dual eligible coverage. And I think that it happens. I think that what people realized when they were writing this law is that it happens very, very frequently. I don't know. I can't fact check the claims that it's very wealthy people who do this.
I'm not suggesting it's only wealthy people that do that, because
right.
I don't believe that at all.
I know a lot of people, it's kind of average, you know, everyday people, and they spend down their assets. And it's really painful for a lot of people to do this because they don't have much to leave for their children. And so the law was passed to raise the asset limit, but it wasn't by much.
No, I mean,
they didn't really do anything to fix that loop, like any kind of loophole that would make that possible, like transferring your assets mm-hmm. or something. They didn't do anything to fix that another way, from what I could gather.
No, I don't disagree with you. I think that the asset limit is still low. But I think that, you know, it's very difficult to pick out one element of the Medicaid issue and address that has any kind of meaningful way across the system. I think we're going to it really does need a much broader, comprehensive overhaul, in my opinion.
So one of the other things that I've heard often from especially people on the House Budget Committee on the Republican side is that the cost of the Medicaid program is going up, 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 and up, and that is going to be making the budgetary situation difficult. It's going up even though the eligibility in Missouri for adults is probably the lowest it can be. For children, it's higher, and for disabled, it's higher. But do you foresee Republicans trying to do anything to the Medicaid program as a way of controlling the budget, or is it pretty much so fixed in to the budgetary system right now that changing it is going to be basically impossible without running afoul of federal laws or regulations?
Well, I think that because of the dramatic increase in spending in the Medicaid portion of the budget, we're gonna have to do something. I mean, excuse me, pharmacy costs in particular continue to rise exponentially. We're going to have to do something budgetary. It may be painful. It may be easier now with a Republican governor. But I think we can't, in my opinion, just take the position that you stated. It's just too deeply ingrained. We can't fix it. We're going to have to try and do something.
Well, I think, I mean, for a little bit of context here, I think some of the reasons that at least the Medicaid Oversight Committee has pointed to is the increasing cost of health care overall.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also had like the hepatitis C cure, which was incredibly expensive. And, you know, it exists. That's great. But it's also, you know, that cost is borne by insurance providers. And then also, I think, managed care. There's been an expansion of that, and it doesn't appear to have a huge cost savings because there's administrative costs that go on top of that.
Yeah, we are going to expand Medicaid to the borders. You know, we had the I-70 corridor for the managed Medicaid.
You're expanding managed Medicaid to the borders.
Expanding managed Medicaid.
Not the qualification.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. We're not.
Yeah. But we should just.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Because that can be confusing.
Yeah, that it is confusing. And so, you know, when you talk to the managed care companies, we just went through that bid process and exchanged one of those companies, you know, for a different provider. And we'll see if they can effectively move the needle on cost containment, and what that means when we expand managed Medicaid beyond the I-70 corridor. We'll see how that. You know, I'm hopeful that as a general, and I've said this to everybody, the managed care companies that have come talk to me, managed care I think presents its problems in a lot of places. From a provider perspective, which is my experience, but I think with the managed Medicaid, there are some value adds that I think managed care can bring to the table.
So before we get to anything else, Derry, can you explain what managed care is explain managed care is just for our listeners who don't know?
Yeah. Okay. So when you have coverage through Medicaid, it's a public insurance program paid for by state and federal money for people who are poor, disabled, or pregnant. Mm-hmm. And basically, in some parts of the state right now, Medicaid is paid for by fee-for-service. So if I go to the doctor's appointment, that doctor's appointment is billed directly to the state. If I'm on managed care, so if I live in St. Louis, I go to my doctor's appointment. That doctor bills my insurance provider, which is a private company, possibly Centene. I think, is it Centene?
There are three. Our state, we have three contracts let. MoHealth, might have to double check the name of that company, but then Centene, and now United.
Right, and they are paid by the state for my overall care, and I also probably have a caseworker who is coordinating my care to say, okay, well, you know, you have COPD, so let's make sure you get to this appointment and this appointment. There are some preliminary evidence suggests that it does not cut down on the number of times people visit the emergency room for a non-emergency. That's been a critique. But I think when we talk about Medicaid expansion, I think another thing to bring up is that there's a lot of evidence in a lot of states that it can actually reduce the cost of care when people aren't waiting for their condition to get really, really to an emergent level, because they, you know, if they don't have coverage, they're pushing off that care until they absolutely have to go to the ER. And it's easier to manage that condition with regular appointments if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, for example.
Well, the key to providing efficient health care is providing the right care at the right time in the right location. Mm-hmm. And what you said earlier is absolutely true. It's been very challenging to find evidence that the managed care has reduced the use of emergency room as the source of first care, you know, regardless of the condition. And I think that's something that I know the managed care companies are working to get their arms around. It's also, as you mentioned, caseworkers that can be provided. I think this is the place where managed Medicaid can help direct the patient to the right care at the right time at the right location. It's a matter of, in healthcare we talk about utilization. It's just getting the proper utilization, and I think that's the benefit of managed care. I hope it can help us rein in our costs, because the costs are going through the roof in our state. You asked about managed care in general. Managed care exists outside of Medicaid, you know, in the adult population. Well, in the general healthcare population, mm-hmm. and the industry as well.
So I wanted to shift gears to the new legislative reality with a Republican governor coming in. Eric Greitens will be sworn into office in early January. You'll no longer have a Democratic governor to kick around anymore to override his vetoes or not override his vetoes. I think generally, before we get into more specific topics, how is that going to change the way Republicans who control the legislature by huge majorities operate, given that they no longer have to get to 109 or 23 anymore? They can just pass things by simple majorities. What's kind of your feeling about Greitens?
Well, it's really about Eric Greitens, I think we have a chance to really advance some legislation that has been sort of had the brake pedal on it for a long time. I've actually heard Governor-elect Greitens himself say, "Look, having a majority in both chambers with a Democratic governor has been like having a race car with the parking brake on," and I think we can take off the parking brake now and advance legislation. I think we need to do that thoughtfully. I think we need to do that carefully. Last thing I want to see us do is get power drunk and just run stuff through. I don't want to see the legislature file, you know, 10,000 bills because now we have a Republican governor that we think we can get that passed. I think we need to be very thoughtful about what we do. But I'm excited. I think the day after the election, woke up thinking about things very differently. I mean, it affects a lot. I mean, we have caucus members, as you know, that we have 100. It may be more difficult to manage a 117 member caucus than a 90 member caucus in some ways, you know, because we have caucus members that we do not agree on everything, and that's to be expected.
And one of the things that I thought about after Greitens won is I think people are going to be able to vote more independently now. There's not going to be this huge pressure to vote party line on everything. If all you have to do is get to 82, I think there still will be pressures from various entities to do priorities.
Sure.
But I think it does allow legislators to have a little bit more independence on voting on bills. Is that fair to say or not really?
No, I think it is fair to say. I think, you know, I mean, the one that comes to everyone's mind is labor, right? Mm-hmm. And we had several labor caucus members that didn't vote with the caucus on labor issues. And I think it really changes the dynamic for them. I mean, they can be much more confident in their vote. They maybe not as much consternation with their vote if they need to vote their district or whatever. It changes a lot. It really does.
What are some of your priorities going forward this year?
Going forward this year, I'm going to carry a few bills that I carried last year. Couple of them around what I believe to be help our state with economic development issues. I carried the transportation network company, the TNC bill, last year. I'm really excited about. I think Speaker Richardson is feeling very energized by the possibilities of that bill.
And can you tell us a little bit about
it?
Yes,
I was just going
to. Because I actually don't know.
Well, that's okay. Transportation network companies are companies like Uber and Lyft. And currently in our state, there does not exist a statewide regulatory platform for them to operate. So if you're an Uber driver in Kansas City, Missouri, you have a different regulatory environment. If you drive outside of Kansas City and drive up to St. Joe with a fare, you might be illegal in St. Joe or in Platte County.
Technically, I think it's illegal in St. Louis right now, in St. Louis County. I don't think it's ever been approved yet. I hear people all the time say they've used Uber, so it's happening.
I've used Uber.
Yeah. I've only used Uber in other cities, but continue.
Yeah. No. So they are operated in St. Louis on a limited basis. And there actually is a lawsuit right now between the city of St. Louis and Uber. But it's not just an Uber bill. It is a transportation network company bill. There are other companies in that space like Lyft, et cetera. And but Uber alone said our legislation passes and they anticipate a minimum of 10,000 new small businesses created by independent Uber drivers in our state.
So by doing a statewide regulatory system, would you basically erase all the local regulations and basically put it under one big state mandate, essentially?
It would be a statewide platform. So they would get their – they would Uber would register with the state. The drivers would register with the with Uber or the transportation network company, and they would be – basically not have the fear of crossing a county line or a municipality and suddenly being illegal.
So what would you
– I have a similar bill that I filed last year in the world of electrical contracting. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about getting your license to work as an electrician, but as a contractor. I filed a bill that I intend to file this year that would create a statewide regulatory platform for electrical contractors, because currently – there are electrical contractors in our state that have to apply for and maintain upwards of 90 or 100 different licenses with every municipality that they choose to do business in. And that's an example of a regulatory climate that just is not conducive to small business.
What do you think that the lay of the land is going to be on some social issues like restricting abortion rights or guns? Because it seems like even though you had a Democratic governor, the legislature was still overriding the governor on it. It seems with a Republican governor who is purportedly opposed to abortion rights and supportive of less restrictive gun laws, you'll have a pretty, you know, free rein to do things on that in that space. What's kind of the lay of the land on that?
Well, there hasn't been, you know, in our caucus meetings, even since the election, the caucus priorities were – as stated by leadership, tended to fall into labor reform, tort reform, which That's another issue that you asked about my priorities. I do have a tort reform bill that changes how punitive damages are adjudicated, which I think is a very interesting bill. I think it's but so the priorities when you speak to leadership, they'll talk about tort reform. They'll talk about
labor
reform, yeah, and education reform. So I don't know that there's, you know, on the abortion rights issue, you know, obviously there's a federal we have Roe v. Wade, right? So there are – I don't know how much more we can continue to restrict. I mean, I would be in favor of that if we could. The gun bill that we just had the big
override
on. I mean, I don't know what the next gun bill – those aren't bills that I carried. I supported them.
Yeah. Well, I just mentioned that because Duri and I were kind of talking offhandedly – before the show, that since I started covering Missouri politics, there's been usually a bill to restrict abortion access every year. And they've all passed because there's usually a bipartisan coalition in both chambers to support that. And I'm just wondering, as you kind of alluded to, how much further you can go. There's only one abortion clinic, Planned Parenthood clinic in the state that's operating right now.
Well, no, there's a lot of clinics that operate. There's only one clinic in the state that can prescribe the abortion pill or give a surgical abortion.
Thank you for correcting me about that. But it just seems like at some point you kind of run out of things to do before you try to ban it outright, and that runs into the Roe v. Wade situation. So you're not seeing that as a priority over the next couple of years at this point?
Well, you know, for those that are on the in the pro-life camp, I think that the ultimate banning of abortion would be our ultimate goal. You know, I don't see how much farther we can go as a state until there's a change in the Supreme Court.
I'm kind of wondering I think there's like 36 pages of Missouri abortion law right now. And we saw funding cuts this year to Planned Parenthood, which prescribes a lot of contraception and things that prevent unwanted pregnancies and therefore reduce the number of abortions that happen. So I've always, I'm mostly interviewing people in the health and science world. Mm-hmm. And I think that one thing I haven't yet understood is what the ideal is. You know, if we're cutting back both access to abortion, but also access to preventive methods. What's the solution here? What is your camp striving for?
I don't think there's any objection if Planned Parenthood said we're no longer going to perform abortions. We're going to actually perform things that what most people, I believe, think of as women's health. You know, the number of mammograms that they perform is minuscule compared to their abortions. And they talk about the percentages.
That's not true.
You have to count. You have to take a look at how they're doing the counting. Are they counting every patient? Are they counting everything that they do for every patient? You have to take a look at the numbers. To really understand it.
For context, according to Planned Parenthood, generally, it's, I think, 3% of the procedures that a Planned Parenthood affiliate performs are abortions. That includes things that are like the abortion pill, which goes up to 9 weeks.
Ask Planned Parenthood what percentage of the actual patients that walk in receive an abortion. So, not as a percentage of the procedures, because if they walk in, because if you look at how they count their numbers, it will be if you walk in and you get anything, if you get I don't know what all they – I mean, they count every single thing they do for that patient as a procedure.
Okay.
But if you ask them what percentage of the patients that walk in your door get abortions, and just come back and see what that number is.
Where do you get that information? I mean, what's the number that you're working off of when you make these votes?
When I make these votes, we haven't had any votes on other than helping to defund Planned Parenthood, which I would love to do if they're going to remain in the abortion business.
Right, but I guess what percentage are you working on for that?
For me, it comes down to when do you recognize that life exists and what rights does that life have? Because if you say that the newly conceived fetus has no rights, when do the rights begin? You know, if we were to listen to Hillary Clinton, you can abort that baby the day before they're due.
That's not true.
She said they have no rights. She said they have no rights.
I don't remember her saying that.
I don't think, no. And to be clear, in this country, at least in every state that I have been able to look up the law for, abortions, late-term abortions, which would be, I think, after the second trimester. Is it during the second trimester?
Basically, you can't
get an abortion after the second trimester unless it's to save the health of the mother. If you end a pregnancy in the ninth month, that's called a C-section.
No.
I really think
Google a video for Hillary Clinton saying that the unborn child has no rights under our law up until the date that they're due. You can find the video.
Okay. Well, I'm not aware of this video.
I'm not aware of it either, but I will Google it.
I think that this debate in this country has, I do feel like the two sides of this issue, they're operating with different facts, you know, and that worries me because I think that makes it really hard to have a civil dialogue in this country that actually is about healthcare and you know what we're doing. Going back to the number of abortions or the percentage of women who receive abortions at Planned Parenthood, where do you get those numbers?
I have read several studies about this. There are different organizations that publish these numbers. I don't know if you've ever seen videos by PragerU. I would look at that if I were you.
Videos?
I can't remember exactly. Well, they're like educational videos, yeah.
Okay. And then they did a survey of Planned Parenthood
patients.
Have you
ever heard of PragerU? Have you seen any of their videos?
I haven't, no.
I haven't okay. either, no.
Yeah. Take a look at some of them. They speak to all issues, social issues, fiscal issues, economic issues.
Okay. What percentage of...
Ask them yourself. Find out. Maybe prove me wrong. Go and find out. Ask them what percentage of women that walk in the door wind up with abortions.
They told me that it was 6% in St. Louis because they are the only
clinic.
No,
they told you that it was 6% of procedures that they do, right?
I think that is the language. Yeah, I will give you that.
Yeah, just find out.
Are there any other issues that you expect to be a major priority when the legislature comes back in January?
Yeah, I think tort reform will be.
Yeah, can you kind of elaborate on that?
Well, I'll give you an example of my bill. So right now, in any civil action, the plaintiff can file for punitive damages before any discovery, before any understanding that there is a cause for punitive damages. And what that does is and literally every lawyer will do it in a sense out of practicing defensive law, right? Because they don't want to later discover that there could have been punitive damages into the case and they've done their client a disservice by not filing at the first pleading. But the effect that has is our court systems are pretty clogged. Judges and lawyers are all trying to point people towards settling these cases rather than having them adjudicated by a jury. What that does is it puts a cloud over the settlement discussions that the threat of punitive damages, whether or not there's any cause of action for those punitive damages or not that could be proven in a court of law, that cloud hangs over those negotiations. My bill was very simple. All it said was that you cannot, with your initial pleading, plead punitive damages until you convince the judge that there is a reasonable expectation that you would win an opportunity to apply punitive damages to the case. Mm-hmm. And that's done in a subsequent pretrial hearing before it actually goes to the jury. And I think that what we would find is a real fair adjudication of punitive damages, that where punitive damages were clearly warranted in the case, that's what we wind up with. Where there's no evidence of punitive damages, the settlements will be much more fair.
Are you talking about any types of torts specifically?
No.
Okay.
Any types of torts.
Yeah. Any civil action where the classic punitive damages case is the old Ford Motor case with the Ford Pinto, which neither of you guys were probably ever around may have never even seen a Ford
what year
Pinto.
What year was the last Ford Pinto come out?
I don't know, but my sister had one, and she graduated high school in 1972.
Wow, so probably not.
Yeah.
I was born in 1984, but maybe the past version of Jason Rosenbaum drove a Pinto. I'm not sure. But
so there was a cases where they had designed the vehicle poorly, and on a rear-end collision, the gas tank, which was near the back of the car, would explode and mm-hmm. kill people. Rather than recall the millions that they sold and fix the problem, which would have cost them tons of money, they rolled the dice and said, we'll settle the wrongful death suits that happen as a result. So clearly they acted in a way with willful negligence of not protecting the public by continuing to produce these vehicles that way and not recall them. That's the classic case where punitive damages mm-hmm. is warranted. But now nearly every action against an employer will include punitive damages before any discovery. They don't know if there's any cause of action for punitive damages, which means that the settlement negotiations that they enter into almost immediately have this punitive damages threat over them, sometimes warranted, oftentimes not.
I would have to imagine this is one of the bills that's going to have an easier time being implemented with a Republican governor, especially when you replace that a Democratic governor who is friendly with attorneys and trial attorneys. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say.
Fair to say.
I think we'll see tort reform type bills move much easier.
Thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate the discussion on a whole range of topics, and we'll be watching what you do in the legislature very carefully. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter @JRosenbaum. Follow Dury on Twitter @DuryB. I don't think you're on Twitter, but is there any other way we can find you on the World Wide Web?
I actually am at Twitter, but I'm not a big tweeter.
Yeah. So. Do you have a Facebook page or a website or something like that?
Yeah, it's just my Facebook page.